Welcome to Oncology Today, optimizing the identification of HER2-low breast cancer. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Kimberly Allison from the Stanford Cancer Institute in Stanford, California, and to begin, she commented on what a medical oncologist should look for in a local pathology lab handling breast cancer specimens.
Local community labs, you know, across the country that are College of American Pathologists certified labs have followed policies and guidelines to get their labs accredited to do, for example, breast cancer biomarker testing. ER, PR, HER2, Ki-67 isn't one of those in their proficiency testing armamentarium, but the CAP has proficiency testing that they set up so that those labs know, you know, are they outliers for their testing? Do they need to correct it? And they can lose their certification if they're not, you know, up to snuff. So, you know, as a medical oncologist in the community, I'd be looking at, are my pathology lab, if they're doing ER and HER2 testing or cancer testing in general, are they CAP certified? You know, how are they vetting their testing? Otherwise, are they sending it out? Because they certainly, there are some local labs who don't want to deal with all of that and will send their biomarkers out to reference labs. A lot of labs do the standard hormone receptor testing. You know, that's a pretty straightforward test, easy to read, easy to interpret. It's HER2 testing that I think I'm seeing more often get reflexed to an outside lab. You know, it might be that they do the IHC in-house and they send out for the FISH testing because that's a more complex assay. Although DISH testing, where you've got you can read it under the light microscope, has become more common. We just adopted that at Stanford, so we can do either FISH or DISH testing at Stanford. But labs that don't have fluorescence in situ hybridization laboratory setups, which is most community hospitals, I would imagine, can do DISH in-house without sending out to a reference lab. But, you know, HER2 is such a high-stakes test, I think, that groups that are, you know, lower volume or, you know, just are not wanting to have to deal with the complexity around making sure you're up to snuff are sending to reference labs.
So just a couple other questions. I know there's a lot of confusion about so-called gastric HER2 testing and breast cancer HER2 testing. Can you kind of explain that? I mean, I hear people saying, we have to talk to your pathologist about whether it's going to be gastric or breast. And like, what does that mean?
Yes, that's true. There are different guidelines and scoring criteria for GI versus breast HER2 scoring. And so, you know, if you are dealing with a metastatic site, I guess you need to let your pathologist know. It's obvious to us when it's from the primary, which scoring system we should use. And then in a metastatic setting, you'd need to know what you were dealing with.
But I mean, in what way is it different? Like, I hear something about heterogeneity or something. Like, why, when they do it gastric, like, what do they do? What do you do differently?
So with HER2, so gastric heterogeneity is more common, as I understand it. Again, I wasn't part of the guidelines for GI. But in breast cancers, the vast majority of cases, 98%, are uniformly positive, amplified, overexpressed, or not. It's very rare to have clustered heterogeneity. That occurs, and we think carefully and we try to report that when we see it. But that's not the norm. And it's much more common in GI. And so they have different criteria and different staining patterns. So instead of circumferential staining of the membranes, they allow for different, less circumferential staining.
So then what do you do now with this pan-tumor approval, which is really oriented around IHC for like biliary and everything else, or, you know, bladder?
So I think they used GI criteria for those, but I'd have to double check for the pan tumor.
There's nothing about FISH in there at all. And it's just IHC 3+. So, you know, for better or worse, but so they're not necessarily going to be getting into HER2 low at this point. They just have the IHC. And again, in terms of quality control and finding IHC 3 plus, like I said, if they're bladder, I don't know what they do. But I can tell you one thing. I mean, HER2 testing with this pan-tumor approval is like out of control. So we're trying to help. You know, that's why we're doing this program. But believe me, I mean, that's what is pushing us right now. As we see all these other disciplines, they have no idea. They don't even know about FISH. They talk about IHC 2 plus, and they don't realize in breast cancer, you have to reflex it.
It's all new. And I know that my colleagues, you know, who are working on changing the College of American Pathologists reporting templates, they're all scrambling to try to catch up and create usable, very straightforward, user-friendly, you know, almost instruct you kind of templates that will allow you to do that scoring in the different organ systems, you know, according to the criteria for each one, to try to help with that. But it's slow, right? To change those templates takes months, if not a year, to get it to push through the system so that it's all in all the community labs that use those templates.
So another thing I wanted to mention to you, I was doing a program the other day with Sarah Tolaney, and when I was going through her papers, I saw that she had a couple of papers on something I hadn't heard before, and I was just curious what your thoughts were, which is ER low, which is kind of like an old topic, but now I see they were looking at it, and like, is that really triple negative? Any thoughts about that? Because it seems really, I mean, very big difference between ER positive, triple negative in terms of the local approach to it. So, like, what's your take on that?
Yeah, ER low was a reporting category created in the last 2020 update for the hormone receptor testing guidelines I was a part of for ASCO CAP. And the crux of it is that, you know, we had to look at data to see what level is predictive of benefit from hormone therapy. We thought about shifting the threshold for positive to a higher percentage than 1%, but the data didn't really support it. We had to look at old clinical trials data, right? Meta-analysis from the 70s when they were doing the tamoxifen trials and, you know, things that aren't going to be repeated today to look at a new threshold, because it's standard of care. You know, when we dialed in and looked at the lower positive range, the 1-9%, 1-10%, you know, there's plenty of literature out there that shows that those profile more like a basal triple negative phenotype. They respond to neoadjuvant therapy more like a triple negative would, but they may still benefit from hormonal therapy. The big issue then was, you know, they were being excluded from triple negative trials, or they were being treated as a, you know, chemotherapy regimens that were for the same as a strong positive hormone receptor cancer. So what we did is, you know, basically called it a gray zone. Here you've got a category 1-10%. Look, there is some hormone receptor expression. You know, think about, is it heterogeneous and your sample's small? Think about, did your assay work well? Do you have good internal controls? Or is this biologically just a low ER expressing cancer that's more like a triple negative? And think about your therapeutic implications. You know, maybe treat it more like a triple negative in that setting.
Yeah, but I mean, that's the point, because as of the last couple of years now, triple negatives getting pre-op chemo and immunotherapy, which you do not use in ER positive. It's completely different. Before, triple negative wasn't as different. Now it's like neoadjuvant. That's a huge decision. So you're saying when you see somebody who has an ER that's less than 10%, to consider the possibility of treating them like triple negative, which would be IO chemo.
I think that is the consideration, yes. And I'm seeing that more at our tumor boards. We used to see those cases presented as a, you know, controversial, you know, why is it it's so low positive? How come you're calling this hormone positive? Now with that low positive category, we're really calling out that these are a real borderline result. They're barely positive for hormone receptors and, you know, probably are going to behave more like a triple negative. I'm actually thankful that PD-L1 testing is not required in that setting. I think it's a really hard test to read as a pathologist, but, you know, high grade, as a pathologist, we might see a lot of tumor infiltrating lymphocytes, and those tend to have more PD-L1 expression. We don't standard report TILs or tumor infiltrating lymphocytes though, until there is a reason to do so, like if there is a trial that shows there's a link to therapy response, then I think pathologists will jump on that bandwagon and start reporting TILs. But you know, currently it doesn't matter, so we don't report it. And you know, traditionally you're looking for something high grade, ER low or negative.
Can you tell me to what extent there's an issue of quality control with PD-1 testing? As you said, it sounded like you thought there was a challenge there.
Yeah. So PD-1 testing, it's a very heterogeneous assay. It's hard to do proficiency testing on that without having, you know, with proficiency testing, you're usually using tumor or tissue microarrays, small little spot samples. And I think that's a hard thing to ensure you're sending the right standards to all the pathologists that are being tested. It's a very challenging scoring system for pathologists to use. The denominator is the numerator includes both lymphocytes and tumor cells, but the denominator includes only the tumor cells for the CPS score. And of course, you know, we have different antibodies and different scoring systems in different organ systems that are relevant. So that's a very, very complex landscape for pathologists. Yeah.
In terms of breast cancer, I think probably the key point for PD-1 testing would be first-line therapy and metastatic disease, because it's, like you said, it's not required in the localized disease. But, you know, it does determine in metastatic disease whether they're going to get an IO if it's over 10%. In terms of that specific assay in that situation, do you think oncologists should feel comfortable or nervous that they may not be getting the best data?
I mean, I think that's often a question of sample as well, right? So if you have a very minimal sample at a metastatic site, you know, you may not be getting the whole picture. It would be great if there was another assay that was a more, you know, liquid form, I guess, that you could really look at for heterogeneity of PD-1 expression. You know, do you test the primary, the metastatic site, how many metastatic sites to get to a positive? I think that's one of the big challenges in the metastatic setting with something so heterogeneous.
Another general question, what about bone as a site? You know, I've heard that that's, you know, problematic for some types of assays related to calcification or something. Like, if the bone is the only site of disease, what do you have to think about?
Right. So bone is challenging because often to get a section at, for histology, we need to decalcify the tissue. So it's great upfront to let the pathology team know that you're going to be doing a bony MET potential, you know, bioassay, biomarker testing, and they can look at other protocols to use that might not involve decalcification or alternative methods. And, you know, say the same is true for ER testing in the metastatic setting or HER2, that, you know, that can be a challenge. When you have a positive result, I think you can be pretty confident that that's a positive result. It's the negative results that, like if it's ER negative in a bone MET that's been decalcified, then I'm worried that might be a false negative, and I can't really say that's always a true result. Many labs don't have, technically for CAP proficiency testing, validation, you're supposed to have validated in different fixatives if you're using an alternative fixative like decalcification, but there's not a high volume of those tests, so a lot of places don't validate in that setting, and they might just report with a disclaimer saying we haven't validated this test for decalcified tissue. these are the results that I've given, but, you know, I can't say that they're validated.
Anyhow, I've learned a lot today. I knew I was going to learn a lot from you, and I did. It was great to work with you. I know you run my old friend George Sledge.
For sure.
I'll tell you a funny story about him. You know, he ran the big adjuvant trastuzumab session in 2005, right? You know, where they announced for the first time the results of the adjuvant trastuzumab session. That was at ASCO when it was in Orlando. And we were doing audio interviews, and I emailed him or I contacted him ahead of time. He said, look, you got to talk to me after you do this presentation. So he said, the only time I have is 5 a.m. the next morning. So I drove over, picked him up 5 a.m. We sat down for an hour. And of course, the main thing at that point was, I want to say, what about node negative, right? Because nobody knew. And he said, no, go. And there was a survey that was done. I don't know if I ever told him this, but that showed that 44% of medical oncologists in the United States heard that interview.
Wow.
That particular
interview. That's huge impact.
I know.
Well, I'm incredibly thankful for that. I'm a HER2-positive breast cancer survivor that benefited from that. I had it.
Say that again.
So part of the reason I'm so passionate about HER2 is I'm a survivor of, I had stage 3 postpartum 16 years ago, HER2-positive breast cancer just a couple years after trastuzumab was approved. So and I was already a breast pathologist. So motivating to get involved in making this testing, you know, the right thing for everybody. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Like, when was it that you were treated? What year were you treated?
2008. So it had
been 3 years after that.
Yeah, it was 2006. It was approved in the non-metastatic setting. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we were surveying by the fall. You know, that was in ASCO, so it was like around June. By the fall, because we did it in the fall, we did a program at the NSABP. By the fall, it was totally happening in practice. It was approved. People were doing it. They were giving. Yeah. It was like instant. But that was in 2005, not 2024. Now that happens all the time. But then, you know, it just bang, they did it right away. But that's incredible that you went through that. Yeah. Have you been, do you share that experience or are you public about it?
Yeah, I mean, I used to speak a lot about it to patient groups and, you know, Komen type audiences and I published a memoir about it and, you know, it was sort of small.
Really?
Small change.
I'm just kind of curious, you know, what the experience was like globally for you. Did you have kids at that time?
Yes, I just had my second kid. So I had a 4-year-old and a, you know, under 8-month-old.
Really? And how old were you?
I was 33.
Wow. And you were already a breast pathologist.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
It was a very ironic. It was a rapid education. You know, what it was like to be treated as a breast cancer patient, kind of with all the different radiation, surgery, chemotherapy, targeted therapy, you know, got to really experience the whole thing, which, you know, really informed my practice. I mean, I don't interact with patients as much as a pathologist, but I began to. So I would see patients if they wanted to talk about their biopsies. I would give talks to patient groups to try to, you know, emphasize too that pathology is a really important part of how you're treated, and that there's a, you know, physician behind that report that, you know, has worked on that.
Do you believe that things happen for a reason?
Yeah, probably did.
Well, if you believe that, which I do, and I feel that way every day, I swear it's guided my company for a long time. But the fact that you now have the expertise in this particular area, and the fact that there's an opportunity to really impact people, this is for real. These people are not going to get the treatment unless the doctors know about it. And if they do get it, they have the possibility of really significant benefit. So.
Yeah.
That's pretty interesting, your history. Yeah. The other thing I want to ask you about, now I remember, I should have brought this up. There's a lot of confusion now because most people with metastatic disease get NGS assays. and they report HER2 mutations, which causes a lot of confusion because HER2 mutant TDXD is approved in lung, but not breast. So they get that and they get, quote, amplified. So, but that's not what they need outside of breast. They need an IHC of 3+, right?
Right. I mean, I guess, so yeah, NGS won't tell you protein expression.
Right.
Yeah, you're right.
So it might be a hint, but they got to get an IHC.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, with these targeted ADCs, it's not about NGS. It's about, you know, I don't know, maybe someday it'll be CTCs.
Well, it depends it depends on the ADC, but in terms of HER2, you don't get out of NGS what you need outside of breast cancer if you want to use this drug other than, you know, colon and, you know, gastric and lung. So anyhow, we've been thinking about, like, how do we get this out to patients?
I mean, it's the same with immunotherapy, right? That's an IHC assay, and it is commonly tested for in the metastatic setting. So what reference labs have done that run NGS testing, they've added things like that to their panels. So they're savvy to that.
Is that right?
You know, yeah. So if you're going to Foundation to get testing, you know, that's comprehensive profiling, you're going to get part of that package can be PD testing and HER2 IHC. Hmm. Like, it's a huge package you get.
How long were you under treatment, incidentally?
It's 6 months neoadjuvant, chemo, surgery, complete path response, and had radiation after. Yeah.
And
I would have had less treatment. Like, I had a whole axillary dissection and, you know, would love to have skipped that. Would love to have skipped that.
How long did it take you to kind of get back to your normal self?
I mean, I was young, so I think I bounced back probably faster than I would today. I was able to work through the whole treatment. I'd take a couple days off a week for treatment and then I was back in the office. So, you know, I took time off for surgery, but not a lot. For me, it was good for me to be at work. But I did have a colleague who was a radiation oncologist who ended up getting breast cancer and, like, couldn't go back into the field. She didn't want to see breast cancer patients. You know, like, it was hard for her. For me, I remember my director asked if I wanted to switch to prostate.
Wow.
for specializing in something. I was like, no, I'm interested in this, you know, very interested in this now. So, it's made me more passionate and want to connect with patients more.
I bet.
Yeah.
Well, I hope maybe we can help give you a little assistance in that regard because we have the same goal.
Great. Well, you're doing good things. Communication and spreading the word is, you know, ultra important. It's how practice changes and lives are saved. So thank you for your work.
Thank you for what you shared with us today. And we definitely will be getting back to you.
Sounds good. All right.
Have a good one. Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Allison, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.